Recalling what we see last day, we saw the notion of thermality, or Gibbs thermality, rather, and we related what we call the von Neumann entropy, which is the Shannon entropy associated with a particular probability distribution over pure quantum states. And we got to the realization that indeed the Shannon entropy is related to a thermodynamic entropy, the von Neumann entropy, which again, remember, the von Neumann entropy is not designed a priori, not constructed to be a thermodynamic entropy, rather an informational entropy in the sense of Shannon entropy. But we found out that indeed Shannon entropy has, the Shannon entropy of density matrix that we call the von Neumann entropy has thermodynamic interpretations as well, right? You can understand it as a thermodynamic entropy. So, the next step, we're gonna deal with correlations. And to deal with correlations, we need to define the notion of multipartite systems that you have seen. So I will be also fast on this. So if you have a bipartite system, AB, that is composed of two subsystems, A and B, all right? Then the Hilbert space associated to the quantum system AB is, of course, the tensor product of the individual subsystems, right, of the used to represent states of the individual subsystems. And if you have two orthonormal bases, one of HA, this one, and one of HB, then the tensor product of the elements of the bases is a basis for the bipartite Hilbert space. Make sense? So the one thing I want to define, just to make sure we set notation and we're all happy, is the notion of partial state. So what is the notion of partial state? Well, imagine that you have a bipartite system AB, but you only have access to one subsystem. And example, your friend took the other, and you kept one. So you want to eliminate all the, when your description of your subsystem A, I want to have the description of my partial subsystem, so I'm not gonna have access to the full system. What is the description, the representation of the partial subsystem A that I have access to? For that, we define the notion of partial trace. Okay. You've been doing partial traces since, well, in several courses. I assume you've seen partial traces before in your quantum introduction, but also you've probably seen them in relativity. For example, the Ricci tensor is the partial trace of the Riemann tensor. Anyway, the notion of partial trace is we're gonna sum the diagonal elements on only one space. All right, make sense? So the partial trace is the sum over B, in this case, of the total state. All right, but again, this thing here, and I say just for completion, right? It looks, if we just stick to the notation, looks like this is gonna be a scalar. It's not, obviously, because this thing has higher dimension than this guy. So what do I actually mean? If I'm rigorous writing about it, what I actually mean is, just for once I'm gonna write it, I mean this operator, of course. All right. All right. So that's what is meant by it. All right, I do nothing on the subspace A, HA, but I sum over the diagonal elements of B. So what results has the dimensions of HA? It's an operator of the dimension of HA. Make sense, everybody? All right, so what we are doing here, informationally speaking, is the same thing that you do in probability theory. I'm summing, I'm getting the marginal distribution over A. I'm summing over all possible states of B. Make sense? Remember, the density matrix is describing probabilities. And what I'm doing is, well, let's sum over all possible states of B, because I have no idea what B could be, to have the probability distribution for A. All the same that you've seen in probability theory, in general relativity, or in your quantum courses. Make sense, everybody? All right. So let's compute the partial trace in three interesting examples of bipartite states because that's going to allow us to understand entanglement a little bit better, or the thing we call entanglement a little bit better, okay? Or at least a limited capacity of it for now, until we define it properly. All right, let's do an example of computing partial traces. Say that I have this bipartite state. So now I'm being nice with writing subindices A and B. I want, and you will see that it's not necessary, right? Because well, the first one belongs to A, second belongs to B in my notation. Make sense? It's a bit redundant to write A and B, but I write it for the first time. Let's get this state. This is a pure state. Agreed? It means that I know exactly what state I have. I have full information about it. The Shannon entropy is zero. The von Neumann entropy is zero. Because I know exactly what state I have. Zero ignorance. Make sense? Everybody? Let's compute the partial state, the partial trace. For example, let's compute the state of subsystem A. Of course, the same definition would go for subsystem B. Yeah. Just swap the A's and the B's. Okay, first of all, let me build a density matrix for this. Right, this is that. Notice that there's something common in quantum info that I won't do, I can tell you, which is you've seen people writing things like that, right? I don't like it. I really don't like it. Why? Because I often work with continuous variables. And what happens if I have, say, I want to write an eigenstate of the X operator? Well, in that case, and it sucks. So I will never write it with an X. Indeed, it feels clever the first time you've exposed to it, then it feels horrible when you work with continuous variables and QFT or space types and things like that. So you will never see me do the X, okay? If you wonder why I do it like that, it's not, well, quantum information people do a lot of that, maybe he's not used to it. No, I was, I had a face. And I quickly discarded it. No offense to anybody who uses it, I just won't, because I don't like it for the reasons I told you. Make sense, everybody? All right. Feel free to use it, if it doesn't confuse you. All right, let's write the density matrix. 1/2, 0, 0, 0, 0, plus, of course, 0, 0, 0, 1. Oh, sorry, 1, 1. Plus, of course, complex conjugate of that, Hermitian conjugate of that, plus 1, 1, 1, 1. All right. So I want to trace row A, I want to trace B, all right? Which means over, of course, row AB. What is that? Well, in this case, this is a two-level systems. So sum over I, we call it I. So I is either 0 or 1. Sum over I, B, row AB. B. Okay. So in this, I'm just doing all the steps because it's the first time I do it. 0B, row AB, 0B, plus 1B, row AB, 1B. Okay. And then we look at this and say, okay, this is easy. These terms are non-diagonal in B, 0 and 1. This term is non-diagonal in B, so I want to give you nothing. These ones are the diagonals in B. This term is diagonal in B. This term is diagonal in B. They give me something. Agreed? What I'm left with is just 1/2, 0A, 0A, plus 1A, 1A. All right. Agreed, everyone? That's the partial state. If you have a subsystem row AB in this state, so system AB in the state row AB, then the partial state of A, if you look only at A, if your friend took B to Alpha Centauri or whatever, that's the state that you're left with when you look at it. Make sense?
Now, how much do you know about the state?
If somebody tells you that the state, how much do you know about the system A? Somebody said it with their hands. You know nothing about A. This is the maximally mixed state, agreed? The state with the maximum mixedness that you can have for a two-level system. The state has the maximum possible Shannon / von Neumann entropy. Agreed? So this is interesting, because I started with a state of which, a bipartite state of which I have zero ignorance to begin with. But if I erase one of the subsystems, I get full ignorance. Make sense? Now, this is interesting, and that doesn't happen typically. If you have two books, even if they're correlated, and you know exactly what it says in each book, and you can understand it when you read it, suddenly, if you erase the information about book B, book A becomes gibberish, has zero information. Ah, that is weird. That's something we don't see every day, no? All right, this is the hallmark, and this is what we use. This is the actual definition, or at least, right, not the actual, the informationally inspired definition of what entanglement is. We're going to see that entanglement, from an informational perspective, is related with how much information about subsystem A do I lose when I erase the information about subsystem B. Make sense? This kind of definition of entanglement is very intuitive for an information theorist. This is something that classically we're not used to seeing. Make sense, everybody? So in fact, I'm gonna use this example to have our first definition that's gonna be helpful for characterizing entanglement. And this first definition is going to be maximally entangled bipartite state. All right. A bipartite state is maximally entangled if it is pure. Okay.
And after tracing out, in fact, one of the subsystems, the resulting state partial state is maximally mixed. Makes sense? That's my definition of maximally entangled state.
What I call maximally entangled state is that, well, the state is pure. I begin, so all maximally entangled states are pure by definition. The state is pure, and after erasing one of the subsystems, and, you know, state is pure meaning I have full knowledge about the bipartite state. I know exactly the bipartite state. I have zero ignorance on the bipartite state. But if I erase the information about one of the subsystems, I'm left with full ignorance. I've lost all information. This is super interesting because, you know, you had originally all the information, but the information was not contained in the individual subsystems, if you want. To get access to all that full information, you better have access to the bipartite system. There's no information left in the individual subsystems. Makes sense? From the informational point of view, typically we're used to, well, the information in the two books is the information of book one plus the information of book two, right? Well, this is not the case here. The information of that state, which is as much as you can have, is not contained in subsystem A, It's not containing subsystem B. It's containing both, but not in the individual ones. Make sense? Everybody? Everybody happy with the definition of maximally entangled state? Any questions? No? Okay. So this is a much better way, and in my opinion, the right way to understand entanglement, right? I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you worked with hand-wavy definitions of entanglement. They are typically very bad, and they're typically misinterpreted both in popular science and in other contexts as some degree of, well, when I measure the first, I instantaneously affect the second. All right? And that is not good. As we discussed a little bit, and we will discuss even more. Entanglement is something like this. There's correlations that, these kind of correlations that are very weird from the classical point of view, that happens that when I erase one of the subsystems, I start with a lot of knowledge, I erase one of the subsystems, I lose knowledge about the other. The information is not contained in individual subsystems. Make sense? I want to emphasize all these things. All right, let's consider a different state, something that is classically correlated, for example. Example two. How about the state? Remember the game that I told you about, that I have a bag that is not transparent. I have two balls, a black one and a white one. And I pick one, and I take it, and you pick the other, and you go away. That one? So that's a case of having classical correlations, right? There is also a two-dimensional system. So let's consider the state, that particular example. What would be the density matrix representing the state of the two balls? Make sense? So this would be an equal distribution of me, say I'm Alice, and you are Bob. So it's either me having the black ball and you having the white one, or it's me, 50% of the time as well, having the white one and you having the black one. All right? There's a classical probability distribution between either. So I have the black one, you have the white one, or I have the white one, you have the black one. Make sense? This is the state representing that little game. And in particular, you see the correlations between them, right? If I were to measure my system, so you see, popular science thing is that, oh, wow, yeah, you have this superposition there, right? If I measure a zero, then apply the projector 0, 0 on A, but that also projects over B, and now I know B has zero, right? If I do the same here, I get exactly the same. So no, that's not what makes entanglement special. This is a classic correlation system. If I measure zero here, I know exactly that the results say we have a one. And nobody in the right mind would say that as I look at my black ball, I'm changing the color of yours or whatever. People would say for that one, but people doesn't say for that one. Make sense? Okay, you can argue, well, in this case, it's probabilistic. This is not sure. There's a difference. But correlations are not action at a distance. Okay, that's what I want to emphasize. Make sense? All right, so this is the very classical, if you want, example where we have correlated colors in our balls. Let's compute the partial trace here to find the state rho A. All right. Now, if you do it very clearly, both of these terms are diagonal in B. Agreed? 1 and 1, 0 and 0. So summing over B would be the sum of the two terms. This is going to be 1 half, 1, oops, 1A, 1A, plus 0A, 0A. Well, unsurprisingly, right? Because the state of my ball is certainly 50-50 black or white. I have no idea what it is because I'm not looking at it. Make sense? In that example? Now, it's true that when I look at my subsystem, I have the maximally mixed state. I have no idea the color of my ball, but of course, that ignorance doesn't come from entanglement in this case. That ignorance comes because I had no freaking clue to begin with. There was already ignorance in the bipartite state, And of course, there's going to be ignorance in the partial states. Make sense, everybody? So this is a, so ending up with full ignorance about a subsystem certainly is not an indication of entanglement. The indication of entanglement is, well, I had knowledge and I've lost it when I erase one of the subsystems. Make sense? Yeah.
Can you write that as a tensor product? That
no. No, and that's also another example. The definition of a non-entangled state is not a product. That is maybe the baby definition when you work only with pure states. But not for mixed states. You see, this is a classically correlated state. But really good question, because when we define entanglement properly, it's certainly not either a product or you're entangled. Not at all. This is a sum of two products. So a convex combination of products shouldn't be entangled, obviously. It's a classical distribution of products, but we will get there. Very good question. More questions? Again, we will see this properly. I'm going to make definitions of what's entangled and what is not properly. Clearly, this is not a product state. This, as you can tell. All right, so any more questions about this one? Let's do another example. Just to the last example. Just to have three examples to analyze when we have the definitions, it's gonna be now. I'm gonna write it here. Example three. Look at this one, rho AB. 1/4, 0, 0, 0, 0, plus 0, 1, 0, 1, plus 1, 0, 1, 0, plus, did I have all of them? Yeah, 1, 1, 1, 1. And this is equal to, well, this state here that I wrote is the maximally entangled, sorry, the maximally mixed state for a system of 2 qubits, agreed? Definition of qubit, does everybody know what a qubit is? Who can tell me the definition of a qubit? Just to make sure we all know the same. Anybody, yeah?
A state in a two-dimensional qubit space.
Not a state, but yeah, a qubit is a quantum system that is a two-dimensional quantum system. Okay, a qubit is a two-dimensional quantum system. Make sense? That's a qubit. That's what we call a qubit. This thing is the maximal, this is the identity in the four-dimensional Hilbert space, agreed? All the diagonal elements. And in fact, this is actually, well, let me write it like that. In fact, of course, this is actually a product state. Make sense? So I started with full ignorance, as much as I can have for the 2 qubits. And of course, that is a product state, meaning there's no correlations between them, and we will talk about it. Like, if you have a product state, that means completely uncorrelated state. We'll talk about it in a second. But of course, in this case, the trace over B of a 1/2 trace over B identity on A, tensor identity on B, is just 1/4 identity on A, trace of the identity of B. And that is 1/2 identity of A. So again, it's the maximally mixed state again. Huh? You have zero knowledge about A, but that's not surprising because you had zero knowledge to begin with. See the difference between these two cases? Here, there's information. A, the subsystem A, measuring subsystem A will give you information about B. There's correlations in here. Agreed? Agreed, everybody? The state of, if I measure a zero, it means that for A, I have a zero, for B, I have a one. Agreed? So there is information about B when I measure A. Here, there isn't. This is the full ignorance bipartite state. This is not the full ignorance bipartite state, but the two partial systems in both cases are fully ignorant. Maybe this is the same, huh? This is the maximum limit state. Agreed, everybody? Do we see the difference between these three examples? Any more questions? All right. So now that we've done this work, we are ready to talk about what entanglement is.
Well, I've defined only the notion of maximal entanglement. Where is it here? But we haven't talked about what entangled state is. Let's do that. All right. A bipartite state. Rho AB is set to be a product state if rho AB can be written as the tensor product of rho A tensor rho B. A product state, let me just underline the definition, is the same as a completely uncorrelated state . Okay, so a product state, the density matrix rho AB is going to be the tensor product of rho A and rho B. And it is a state that is completely uncorrelated. There's no information about B that I get by measuring A. Make sense, everybody? This is the case of example 3. Example 3 is a product state. Make sense? It's very easy to see in that case that, of course, the partial state, the partial trace just factors. The partial state doesn't touch subsystem. It's just factors to partial trace over B would be just rho A times the trace over rho B. Make sense? Is that definition understood? All right. A bipartite state is separable if it can be written as a probabilistic distribution of product states. Make sense, everybody? The definition is, well, this is not a product state in general. It can be a product state. That's a particular case, right? But in general, this would be a probability distribution over product states. Make sense? Everybody? So a separable state is a state that can contain correlations, whereas this one is completely uncorrelated. This one can contain classical correlations. An example of this is the example 2 that we saw. So let me just show you here. Example 2 rho A is separable, but not a product. And the separation is as follows. Let me just write it explicitly. Rho 1, maybe I'll put parentheses on this one. Rho 1. I don't need the parentheses. The notes have parentheses, but this is not complicated notation. Rho 1 A is 0A, 0A. And row 1B is 1B, 1B. And of course, P1 equals P2 equals 1/2 in that case. So it's certainly a product state. Sorry, a separable state. Make sense? Everybody? So, we have defined product state, we have defined separable state. Let me define entangled state. Which is the same as non-separable if it cannot be written as a separable state, right? As a separation of state. So, entangled state is the same as non-separable. That's my definition. Maybe if you have said, maybe that's where the question came from, maybe you have seen it before, you have seen it defined only for pure states, and they told you, well, if the state is a product, it's not entangled, or entangled state is a state that cannot be written as a tensor product, right? Of the two. Well, that's not true. That is only true for pure states. In fact, let me just write. Row AB separable. Do I have them here? Maybe not. Let me just write here. Product implies, of course, row AB separable. But the opposite is not true. Okay. If row AB is a pure state, then product, maybe let's write it like that, a little bit better. With pure and separable, then this thing implies product. Right, for pure states, there's no such thing as being separable without being product. Make sense? All right. So, row AB separable, but not a product, means row AB only has classical correlations. What we call classical correlations. So far, so good. Everything makes sense. Please do ask questions, huh? Okay, we have definitions now for what we call entanglement here. So we have an informational notion, and let's discuss it here. An informational notion of what it means to be entangled. The informational notion means, well, if a bipartite system is entangled, erasing one of the subsystems is gonna add to my ignorance of the other one, which is weird because I don't see that classically happening every day. But that's what I associated with entanglement. Make sense? And then we come up with these definitions. Well, let's consider a product state. A state is a tensor product. If I trace the second, I do nothing to the first one. Agreed? If I eliminate the information of the second, I do nothing to the first one. So I'm not going to lose information about the first one. Make sense? Therefore, this cannot be entangled in an informational notion of entanglement. So a product state cannot be entangled. Even more so, there's no information about, if I measure A, I'm not going to get any information about B, because anything that is related to measurements of A, you know, is going to give me zero information about the factors of B, because they factor out, they're multiplied. So this state has no correlations. Maybe let me write it here. Row AB product means A and B uncorrelated. Okay. Make sense? Now we look at the second kind and say, well, yeah, those guys cannot be entangled. But then if I have a classical probability distribution of states that are uncorrelated, that have no entanglement, if you want, well, that also cannot have entanglement. It's just a classical probability distribution of things that don't have entanglement. Make sense? So indeed, that's why this thing cannot have entanglement. If I do it here, if I erase the information about B, it's going to be very similar. I'm going to have in every term, because of linearity of the trace, that this is going to be the trace of B here, and the rho A factor as a tensor, if you want. Times that every term in here would have the trace of the rho I. Make sense, everybody? All right. Now the last one, a non-separable state. Where is it? A non-separable state, a state that is entangled, cannot be written like that. It cannot be a classical probability distribution over product states. So this one, when I trace out rho b, I'm not going to be able to just factor out the trace in every term. I'm going to be touching the statistics of A. Make sense? And I'm going to be losing information about A. That's why this is the definition of entanglement. Make sense? You see, those definitions are given from the fundamental notion of entanglement is related with the ignorance that I gain, if you want, about system A when I eliminate information about system B. Make sense? So you see, the answer to the question is that being product is not the only way you can be non-entangled. You can be a probability distribution over product. But of course, if you are product and pure, then separable and pure, the only way is being product. If you have pure states, the notion of separable and product are the same for the pure states. Unfortunately, in life, it's rare that we have pure states, huh? You know, they don't exist, really. It's thermodynamics. A couple of laws of thermodynamics that prevent you from having pure states. The second and the third, as sad as it is. Make sense, everybody? Yeah? You will have pure states only at absolute zero, with no thermal noise. Yeah.
So, I can have, can I have a state that's like that's like a sum of a separable state and an entangled state or something like that?
You can. It is. That would be entangled because that means that you cannot write the whole thing as that.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but then it would be less entangled than...
Very nice questions. I'm loving your question so far. Like, this is very, because part of the course is going to be about quantifying what does it mean to be more entangled. Keep in mind that this does... So the question is, okay, now we have... We talked about maximal entanglement and we know about non-entangled at all. What happens in between? Can we talk about one state being more entangled than another? And that enters into a problem that is extremely complicated. So let me tell you one thing to begin with. The problem of, if I give you a random state, and I ask you, is that entangled? That question is in the complex, do you know about complexity classes? This question is NP hard. NP hard means that it's as hard as the hardest problem in NP, whatever hard that is, because we don't know. Hanwavy, just for everybody. Hanwavy, recollection of things, right? P kind of problems are problems that are easy to solve and easy to check solutions of. NP are problems that are probably difficult, or no, they can be also the P ones, can be difficult to solve, or at least we don't know how to solve them easily, but they're easy to check the solutions of. That's NP hard. That's NP, sorry. And NP hard is, because P is inside NP, so if you have NP, the big one, and you have P is inside. Again, we still don't know, although we know that these two things are different, but of course we don't know. It may be the same, the P and NP are the same, right? So that's why I have to be careful with the language when I say things. NP hard is the intersection of NP and P, the complement to the intersection of NP and P. So the problems that are at least as hard as the hardest problem. Make sense? In NP. So it is a difficult problem, or at least we believe that it is a difficult problem. So difficult that, we have come up with a lot of research was dedicated to try to find particular cases where it's actually easier to check if there's entanglement in it. And of course, we also have something called measures of entanglement, entanglement measures. Entanglement measures
their objective, and this is one of the things that we're going to see, not the next one, because the next one is about Bell inequalities and what makes quantum, I guess, when we have entanglement. But we will see in a big chunk of the course how we attempt to measure entanglement. For pure states, we do have something, and this is very important. For pure states, it's like, well, for pure state, I start with full knowledge, right? If I have a pure bipartite state, I have full knowledge to begin with. And I erase one of the subsystems, now I have ignorance. I have the perfect measure for that ignorance. Because the amount of ignorance in that case will tell you how entangled you were. Makes sense? If I have, remember, maximal entangled means that when I erase one of the subsystems, I'm left with full ignorance. That's the most entangled you can be. But you can be left with less ignorance. Well, nice. So we can use the von Neumann entropy of the partial state, the Shannon entropy of the partial state, to quantify how entangled you were. Because that's literally quantifying how ignorant you are about A after erasing B. So the von Neumann entropy of the partial state is indeed a measure of entanglement for pure states. So much so that people call it entanglement entropy. That's the name that we have for a bipartite state, the entanglement entropy. And we will see all that. You don't need to write it down. We will get there. But the entanglement entropy is indeed a perfect measure of entanglement if you were with pure states. The name is really bad. Opinion piece. Eh? The name entanglement entropy is truly awful. Why? Because it suggests that it's a measure of entanglement. It is not, because if you start with this or this, even this, to make it worse, this example, you knew nothing about the two subsystems, but the von Neumann entropy of the partial state is maximum as well. Well, no crap. You knew nothing at the beginning. Of course, you knew nothing afterwards. But that doesn't mean there's any entanglement. In fact, this is a freaking product state. It's completely uncorrelated. So if you were to compute the entanglement entropy on that state, you get maximum. I was, oh, so entangled. Well, it's not. That's why the name is really bad. I've seen, not anymore, but some years ago, I've seen papers computing entanglement entropy. So for example, papers that were trying to quantify correlations between fields in two regions of space-time, right? Finite regions. And they say, well, I have, this is the state of the things. Let me compute the entanglement entropy of that state. Well, that state is not pure. So the entanglement entropy will tell you nothing about entanglement in that case. So we will discuss that because we're going to discuss what is a measure of entanglement. And there's going to be a compromise. Either you have a measure of entanglement or you have something easy to compute, but both is going to be impossible. That doesn't exist. There's no function that is easy to compute and quantifies entanglement. So you have to make compromises. When we define entanglement measures, we have to make compromises. Do you want to be correct and rigorous and nice, or you want to be able to compute something ever? You have to choose. And we will talk about the different measures and the different balances and choices that we have to do. I have to make. When we get there. Make sense? Entanglement is tricky. Entanglement is tricky. And it's tricky because determining if something is entangled is a hard, we believe, is a hard problem. Question, yeah?
What makes it hard?
What makes a mathematical problem hard? The fact that we don't know algorithms that... So the definition of complexity you want, there's no algorithm to compute that we know of, to compute if a state, to decide if a state is entangled or not, that scales well when the system becomes big. For example, if we typically call easy, if this the problem of deciding whether a state is entangled or not, the time it takes to solve it and the amount of space that you need to solve it grows polynomially, we typically say, well, it's easy.
But I'm trying to understand what problem do you actually run into which makes it take a long time in this
taking that it's just a case. It's not one particular thing. It's just a mathematical problem that requires a lot of computational resources to solve with our best algorithm. It may be that we don't know, and there's an algorithm that does it very fast. That's related with P versus NP, right? If NP ends up being the same as P, then it's just us being stupid not knowing how to do it. But if not, it means that there's no algorithm that scales nicely, like polynomially, that can tell you if that state is entangled. Make sense? It's just a mathematically complicated thing to solve. All right. It's like factoring prime numbers in math, right? Like, what makes it difficult? Well, it's difficult. So there are better algorithms than this, right? But we know as kids already that notion that, if you want to decompose a number in prime factors, it becomes more difficult the larger the number because there are more primes that you need to check, right? That's not the best algorithm, of course, but even the best that we know of that doesn't use anything quantum is not polynomial. Makes sense, everyone? Cool.
So the next thing we're going to do, and I'm going to set it up only, because we're going to discuss the notion, the two notions that are very important to understand from foundations, which is the notion of locality and the notion of realism, because we're going to run into a semantics problem with this. And the semantics problem is that there's a whole field that uses the word locality in a way that is different from what I believe should be. But there are two notions of locality, if you want, typically, that people use and throw around, okay? All right. We're going to begin today the discussion about locality, realism, and Bell inequalities. All right, the whole thing was started, if you want, on the discussions in conferences. There were two teams, if you want. You have Einstein and other people, like Podolsky and Rosen. But Einstein was in the famous ones, but both of the three of them are extremely important here. And you have the other side, that is Schrödinger and Bohr. Makes sense? The two ways of talking about it, well, they were looking at states like that one over there, and the Copenhagen postulates of quantum mechanics, which included, that we haven't talked about it yet, but we will, measurements. Measurements are important in quantum info, but are extremely important in foundations too. Measurements, in particular, state updates. If I obtain a zero, the first state example one here, if I measure A and obtain a zero, I need to update my state. This compatibility with future experiments, I need to update my state, right? And the Copenhagen people will tell you, well, apply a projector, right? And that led people saying, well, there's action at a distance, you're updating things. There was the discussion, right? And Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, summarizing a lot, wrote a paper in which they said, look, quantum mechanics is unsettling. And the reason it is unsettling is because, that's what they wrote, okay? It's because you are forced to make a decision. And the decision is between two things. Either there's really action at a distance when you project and you obtain a zero and you measure and suddenly you're changing the randomness and the statistics of B, they said. Or quantum mechanics is not complete. Meaning that, well, quantum mechanics is not talking about real quantum. The same way that we talk in statistical mechanics, we talk about pressure, volume, and temperature. But those are not the fundamental descriptors of the system that we have, right? In the paper, they say, well, maybe there are true systems, right? Microscopic scale, microscopic structure of systems, so that there's some notion of realism of the outcome of measurements, meaning that, well, the outcome of measurements are 7 because they were 7 always, because there's some set variables that had these values so that things compare to be 7. Like in the black ball and the white ball example, right? In the classical case, nobody would say, well, when I measure my black ball and I know that yours is white, nobody, if I tell somebody I changed the color by measuring mine, people are going to tell you, no, the color was always there. You just didn't know it. It's your ignorance. See what I mean? So Einstein said, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, they said, by the way, if you want to look at interesting biographies, read about Podolsky. Oh, a bit forgotten. I mean, everybody knows Rosen. Everybody knows Einstein, obviously. But not that much Podolsky. I recommend you read about Podolsky. Very interesting. Anyway, so in this case, they said in the paper, well, you have to choose either action at a distance or quantum mechanics is not realistic. Meaning that it's not describing fundamental stuff. There's fundamental stuff that is unknown that we don't know. Make sense? That's what they said in their paper. Now, of course, Schrödinger and Bohr were defending that quantum mechanics is realistic. There's intrinsic probabilities and it's realistic. And they were more like happy to accept this notion perhaps of action at a distance. They discussed it a bit. When things were fleshed out, Feynman and afterwards, it's like, well, in the end, even if there's that, right, nothing really, information, that's the typical excuse, if you allow me to say that you hear. Well, action at a distance, but information doesn't propagate faster than light, because you need to know to actually realize.
I call that an excuse, even though it's in Brownian foundations. I call that an excuse. And Einstein called this spooky action. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, they call in the paper spooky action. Spooky because it's like, how? And spooky action is at odds with relativity. Agreed? It's very easy. The collapse, the typical collapse description, Copenhagen collapse, of that state, if I measure A, I instantaneously change B. That notion is like, okay, Alice measures first, right? And collapses B as well, and that's how B measures a zero. But what if Alice and Bob do this while space-like separated, right? If Alice and Bob, are space-like separated, their events of measurement are space-like separated. Well, at first, this is, of course, space-time. So if they're space-like separated, somebody would say, okay, a person commoving with this axis, okay, would say, ah, no, Alice doesn't measure first. They measure simultaneously. Agreed? So what happens in that case? Who collapses what? Well, somebody that's moving with some velocity towards the right, the place of simultaneity for that person is are those. Agreed? So if we, that's supposed to be parallel, huh? If we write the time slices for that person moving to the right, well, B measures first, and then Alice measures after. Agreed? So it's B who collapses the system. Well, what about a person moving towards the left? Person moving towards the left has this planes of simultaneity, right? So for a person moving towards the left, Alice measures first, and Bob measures after. So who collapses what? It's observer dependent, that description, agreed? There's no notion of simultaneity that's absolute when you are in space-like separation. Makes sense. So Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, even though they don't say in the paper, we prefer one over the other, so we believe that one is wrong, and so on, they say, well, there are compelling arguments for which this notion of action at a distance cannot exist. Therefore, quantum mechanics should not be complete. They don't say it has to be like that. They say, well, if we are to believe this description, maybe quantum mechanics should not be complete. Is that a question? No. Makes sense? I don't know, you probably know the outcome of this, right? The discussions, Solvay conferences and all, were like, well, this thing is not even, this is a discussion for philosophy, because there's no way to tell in practice. Until somebody came and had a theorem that actually allows you to experimentally check this thing. Actually, you know the outcome, right? Who was right? Huh? Who thinks that Bohr and Schrödinger were right? Who thinks that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen? Oh, okay. You said you are? You're in camp Bohr and Schrödinger?
Yeah.
Who would be in camp Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen? Nobody? Okay. Well, the answer is that none of those are actually accurate descriptions, right? We need something else. Quantum mechanics, we believe it's realistic in a way. We believe it's realistic. No. We believe it's fundamental. Okay. We also don't think that there are action at a distance. Although, again, asterisk on that, because there are people working in collapse models that may contest this claim. But I'll make my claims exact and we'll define. Make sense? Everybody? All right, so let me define, and that's the last thing I do today, the notion of locality and realism. All right, so say we have two labs, A and B. No, two labs, let's call them Alice and Bob. All right, and lab Alice measures quantities A about a bipartite system with lab parameters A.
And Bob measures quantities B with last parameters small b of the same bipartite system. Okay, what is this? So I have a bipartite system. Think of the black ball and the white ball. Alice takes one, takes it to her lab. Bob takes another, takes it to his lab. Okay? And they start doing experiments. They start making measurements. Now, lab parameters A. What do we call A? A are all the parameters in the experiment of Alice that are controllable by Alice, the knobs in the lab. For example, if it's measuring a spin, what direction of spin I measure? Okay? For how long? How many times? I mean, what is the, maybe the things that C can control? What is the volume of my lab? What is the electromagnetic field in my lab? All those things. Things that you can conceive that Alice can measure and control. Make sense? And B is the same, but for lab B, for the lab of Bob. Make sense? Agreed, everybody? Controllable parameters. So the notion of locality means that A is not a function of B, and B is not a function of A. Meaning that touching my knobs in my lab will not affect your experiment far away. Makes sense? It's a very intuitive, very physical notion. Even before relativity, that's a very physical notion. It means that if somebody's doing an experiment in Australia, what they decide to set their knobs in Australia is not going to affect an experiment here. Make sense? Oh, Bob in Australia says, I'm going to measure spin in this direction. Well, that doesn't affect the result of measuring my spin in a different direction that I decide. Make sense? That's the notion of locality. Now, the notion of this is a general notion of locality. If we believe in relativity as well, we have a very well-defined notion of locality, right? Which is locality means space-time locality. And if the two labs are space-like separated, indeed, the decisions made in lab B cannot affect results of lab A. Make sense? Everybody? Now, in general, we will say that A would be a function of A and lambda, and B would be a function of B and lambda. What is lambda? Lambda is the set of variables, think degrees of freedom, that neither Alice nor Bob have control over, all of them. Make sense? Think of anything. Things that are not accessible by Alice and Bob. Alice can be very careful measuring her lab, right? Bob can be very careful measuring his lab and controlling everything, but there's always going to be things that cannot be controlled. Make sense? This is what we're going to call hidden variables. They're called hidden because neither Alice nor Bob can check them. Make sense? And of course, because they're hidden to both, some of them are going to be only affecting Alice, right? For example, imagine that this is the value of some other system, right? In the causal past of both, in the language of relativity, in the causal past of Alice and Bob. Well, that could have affected, you know, get something correlated for both. That could affect the outcomes of measurements. They just don't know. Agreed? So we, with these lambdas, we're going to actually account for any of the possible influence on the measurements of variables that are not controllable by Alice or Bob. And in fact, when we do the derivations with this, when we actually prove Bell's theorem or one of Bell's theorems, we are going to allow those to even be probabilistic. To not be well-defined, they'll be probability distributions. That could be a probabilistic variable, which is more powerful, of course. The determined value for all those variables is just picking a delta as a probability distribution. But we're going to let them not even be that. We're going to let them be probabilistic. Make sense? Yeah.
Are we assuming Alice and Bob are causally connected?
No, we're not assuming anything yet. But, oh, well, I am. Because I'm saying that B, A cannot depend on B. So that is as an assumption of locality. I already made, in general, that would be A, comma B, comma lambda. If I assume locality, A would not depend on B. Therefore, one way of guaranteeing that is make them causally disconnected. This is as effective as being causally disconnected. Make sense? Lambda could be something that happens in the causal past of both and signals both, even though they are space-like separated. Make sense? Could be something else. Could be something that is not necessarily local. You see, the assumption of locality here is only about the decisions made in the lab, the knobs that you can control. How can you even guarantee locality in the pure foundations kind of way? How can you guarantee locality about things that you cannot even measure? This could be things that are still local or not in general, but they're allowed to be local, these things, lambda. Make sense, everybody? So that's the notion of locality. Realism. Objects have definite properties independent of observation. The notion of realism is that, well, the thing that you're measuring has an independent property that doesn't depend on you measuring or not. Make sense? That is the thing you can tell, right? In here, in example one, you cannot have both. Because either when you measure, right, the update would update both, right? You measure zero, you update the system, and you have zero on the other one. So either the value was not determined before the measurement. Again, I already told you that that kind of description is not good with that, but let's assume that we fix a frame and we talk about it like this. Either you know, either the value was already fixed, like in the case of taking a black ball or a white ball, or I did something not local. My measurement in A, you see, affected B. So you see that both things are going to be tough to reconcile, at least intuitively. Yeah, we're going to do it rigorously. People didn't think we could distinguish. People would say, well, no, not really, because you have to communicate. People would say, you have to communicate the outcome of the measurement, and the information will travel only at the speed of light, so you cannot even tell if there was something local or not. People did say that. Huh? In this discussion, people say, there's no way to tell. You're telling me that you have to choose? Not really, because you will not know. B will not know that Alice measure until the information arrives to B. So how can you distinguish if there was something local or not? You can't, because you cannot communicate to tell, oh, it was instantaneous. You can't. You need to wait, right? So people said, you cannot really. This discussion is a moot point, it's because there's no way to check. Agreed? That's what they said. They were wrong. There is a way to check. In fact, in 1984 was the first time we checked, right? That's what we're going to do. But you see, the notion, hopefully this is clear, the notion of locality and the notion of realism. And you see, in here, if there are values, right, the notion of realism has to be in the hidden variables. So if there are values that fully determine the outcome of the measurement, it cannot be if things are local, A and B, it has to be in the hidden variables. Agreed? So you can think about it, locality is implemented by not letting A depend on B, on the small b, on the settings of B, and B on the settings on A, and realism is implemented by allowing the existence of hidden variables. Make sense? Imagine, for example, if quantum mechanics was not fundamental, this is an effective description right there. And then there would be variables with values that are set, right, that determined that, of course, the outcome of the experiment would be the same as in the think of the example of the two balls, right, the classical balls. It's 50-50. When I measure mine, I know yours, and not before that. But they were hidden variables. They were the color that was set from the beginning, right? You just had ignorance about it. Yeah.
Do we make any assumption that they depend on the same hidden variables? Should they be
The same. Alice may depend. These variables are many, right? In general, infinitely many. Maybe A depends on 10 of them. This one depends on 15 of them. And two of them could be common. But yeah, the idea is that in general, they can have. We allow them to have neither none in common or all of them or some of them. I don't care.
We're going to prove. You see how people thought, or why people thought, that it would be very tough to actually check? It's because how are you going to check this hypothesis, right, in an experiment? It's kind of vague. And this is one of the super nice, easy, powerful results, where we can check something in principle very difficult very easily. But it took Bell to come. Bell was a philosopher of physics, by the way, just so you know. Never underestimate. Philosophers of physics tend to know more fundamental physics than most physicists, and a lot of math as well. Yeah.
To which scale beyond which scale we believe that Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics is valid?
I do not. There are flaws in the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics.
For example?
We will get there when we see POVMs. Yeah. I would not. I'm not a collapse person. I think that collapse is a convenient fiction, meaning that it does work sometimes and it's great, right? Because we use it for in practice, right? But if you were to do, if you were to assume that the fundamental, again, we get into the opinion piece if you want. Huh? But if you were to assume that fundamentally what we have is QFT, right? We have a notion of locality that relativity imposes. This collapse has to come as a mechanism of some kind. So the Copenhagen postulate 4, I'm not gonna subscribe, and we will see something else instead. But then again, we are. These things are opinable, if you want. So when we get into interpretations, things get a bit muddy, right? Who's correct? Well, but in one thing that the nice thing about this is because is that people thought that that was interpretation. If quantum mechanics is complete or not, because of this issue, was thought to be an interpretation thing, a pure philosophy discussion, where it's not. It's actually physical, and as we will see in Bell's theorem. We can have experiments that distinguish whether quantum mechanics is local realistic or not. Make sense? In fact, what we're going to prove, and we will discuss this, is that quantum mechanics cannot be local realistic. And now it's up to us to decide which one fails. Because Bell inequalities will not tell you if it's non-local or if it's non-realistic. It will tell you that it's not local realistic. So either locality fails or realism fails or both. You decide. And if you ask me, I would say that locality is sacrosanctum. Locality has to be kept because relativistic considerations, I would say. This is opinable, okay? So I would say that quantum mechanics is not realistic, but it's local. But then again, we will discuss all this and we'll hear opinions, and then we can. I'll be thrilled if you had opinions that contradict mine, because it's the nice way of discussing this. Make sense, everybody? All right, so more on that on Wednesday. We will see the theorem. It's a beautiful one.